Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to Beekeeping for Newbies. This is going to be Bee Buzz episode 17. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. As always, I do appreciate you. Feel free to reach out, Jeff at beekeepingfornewbies.com. That's N-E-W-B-E-E-S.com. All right, folks, so we got a couple of updates here. As I've said before, we only do the personal updates in the Bee Buzz. So if you don't want to hear about me, this is a really good time to tune out or fast forward a little bit till I get to the actual questions. But not a whole lot. Same old same, right? I'm just doing some bee things here, keeping up with the podcast, trying to get more things put together to do a little better job on the YouTube side of things. I am still working on getting camera stuff figured out, CapCut software, film editing stuff figured out. I had absolutely no idea that when I decided that I was going to do something in beekeeping, but not beekeeping, specifically podcast/video stuff. I had no idea I was going to have to learn a whole new career field in sound and video and all of that. So it's kind of a fun little journey. It is interesting. I guess you kind of have to find a way to teach an old dog new tricks. Anyway, so I guess the biggest piece of excitement, I am working outside in the bed of my truck yesterday, just trying to move a few things around that were in the back. And I hear this sound of something falling out of the tree. Now, it was kind of a windy day, and I thought maybe a small little branch on one of these little oak trees. I shouldn't say little oak trees. I mean, these are all 35 to 100-year-old oak trees, so they're all pretty big and mature. But, you know, when they get to be that age, you get a good wind come through with a storm, and having a few small branches and twigs and things fall out of the tree is not uncommon. So I hear the sound, a very distinct sound of something falling down through the trees, and I thought, oh, crap, it's a little branch coming down. So I instinctively take my left hand and put it on top of my head because all it takes is a single hand to stop a 500-pound branch from knocking you unconscious. I don't know why that was the instinctive thing, but I did that. And then I heard it hit the ground. I don't know. It was about 20, 30 feet away. I couldn't tell. And I thought, man, I wonder how big that stick or log or branch, whatever it was that came down off of that tree. I was kind of curious as to how big it was because it had a pretty good thud to it. I walked around the front of my truck. I'm looking towards where I have this swarm trap hanging off of this oak tree. And I glanced just to the right of where this swarm trap is and pretty much had a mild heart attack. There was a 6-foot black rat snake that had fallen from the tree and was laying there right in front of my truck, like, you know, upside down. So its light colored, you know, underbelly was exposed. But yet right up there near its head, about 6 inches or 8 inches from its head, it had turned itself and it was looking at me. And I didn't really know what to think. I just, I would have been, I guess, shocked and surprised and fully expected the snake to die had the same thing not happened. I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago, about 40 or 50 feet from where I was standing yesterday, the exact same thing happened and one landed on my Bronco. And I was looking the other way and I just thought, oh my God, what just fell on my Bronco? But there was no evidence of anything. You couldn't see anything. I walk around the Bronco and right there on the floor, right there on the ground is this big old snake. And again, the first time that happened, I thought, oh my God, it's dead. It's over. And I walked away. I'm like, what am I going to do? You know, my daughters have had, you know, pet snakes. So they love having the snakes around the property. And I thought, crap, I don't want to have to tell them about this. And I go and I mentioned it to somebody and I came back out. And as I'm walking back out to the truck, it's slithering away. So apparently this is how they exit trees from time to time instead of, you know, making the trip back down the tree, which I guess it's not easy for them to hold on as they're. I have no idea how this whole thing came together. All I can think of is like, oh my God, what if that thing would have been 20 feet to the left? And anyway, so that was my excitement. So if you're in the Discord room, go take a look. I posted some pictures in there. If you're not a Discord person, but you still want to see the pictures, drop me an email and I'll send it your way. Let's see, next on the list here, I've actually started working on a book. I'm working on my outline now for my beekeeping book. I came up with the title yesterday, not going to release it yet because I'm sure there's going to be somebody out there who will try and steal it away and trademark it and copyright it and all that kind of good stuff. So I'm not exactly sure how it's all going to come together and all the details and all of that, but that is underway. I did officially register a new domain for a bee business that I am possibly going to be establishing next year in the spring. But that is still a bit up in the air. We'll have to see how everything else goes. But I wanted to secure the domain because I kind of believe in the concept and the idea of this business. So we'll see how that comes together. During a recent trip across the country with my daughter, this was where she was going out to do an internship out in Wyoming. I went ahead and drove out with her. And, you know, we really had a chance to just meet some pretty cool people and some neat people along the way. And I couldn't help but to think about how cool it would be to just have like a Sprinter van decked out with like beekeeping for newbies, you know, logos and stuff written all over it. And I just kind of travel the country and, you know, meet up with people, interview them, do inspections with them, hear the stories. I've always enjoyed hearing people's stories. I remember going back in the days, like back in the old Army days, we had a lot of downtime. You know, there was a lot of downtime where all of us were just hanging out, chit-chatting, and you get to hear about where they grew up and the kind of food they made and just, it was fun and it was cool. And just to know like how different, but yet how similar that we all are. That's kind of my little dream. I don't know if it's ever going to happen or not. I feel like I've got some pesky little financial things that may inhibit that, but I've done some rough math. I think if I can get to about 250,000 subscribers on YouTube and about 20,000 downloads per episode on the podcast here, we'll have what we need to work with. Everything will be fine. So we're almost there. I mean, we're only like 249,350 away. So we're really close there. 20,000 downloads per episode. We are about 25% of the way there. We're getting about 5,000. So not quite where we need to be. But hey, anyway, next on the list here, my youngest baby is graduating high school in about 2 or 3 weeks here. She was supposed to be on this episode. We all know and love her, the Fee Beekeeper. So she's 18 now. She's going to go to college. She's going to go away, blah, 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 blah. So she was going to be on. And then I said, hey, you going to do this? And she was like, I got to go to work. So she's at work. I will get her on before she leaves one way or another. And I would say the last thing I've really got going on lately is this daggone HVAC issue. That's another thing that I've had to become an expert in because I don't like spending a crap ton of money on things that I just don't think are that complex. I don't want to oversimplify it, but anyway, so I've got an HVAC issue. Hey, if you're an HVAC person, by the way, feel free to drop me an email on this one. So my high side pressure is over 400. My suction pressure on the low end is like 120. My subcooling and my superheat are both in like the 20s and 30s. I think I've got a clog in the TXV valve. I don't know for sure, but there is some frost showing up on the TXV valve. Icing and all kinds of other stuff. So anyway, if you're an HVAC person, feel free to drop me an email. All right, so let's get to the real stuff here. In Kentucky, on Saturday, the 15th of June, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., Man Lake is doing a customer appreciation picnic, and that is going to be at 807 West Main Street in Clarkson, Kentucky. If your GPS redirects you to, I think it's Leechfield, Kentucky, L-E-I-T-C-H Field, Kentucky, use 3107 Elizabethtown Road in Clarkson, Kentucky, 42726 as your destination address. So, hey, if you're a fan of some free picnic food and games and all that kind of stuff, and you're anywhere near the Clarkson, Kentucky area on Saturday the 15th, feel free to check that out. All right, first question on the list. It says, hey, can you talk a little bit about after the honeymoon is over and the next question is, again, I guess they mean like, hey, you got your bees, everything's going great, everything is really cool and exciting. Like, what do you do after the nectar flow? And then ways that you can get them to draw comb without a hive top feeder during the dearth. So the first thing I would say is after the honeymoon's over, there's a lot of things that are going to happen. And I'm probably going to even talk about this again in a separate episode because it's so important just to kind of branch it off by itself. But it's very normal for that queen to start tapering and sometimes completely stop laying eggs in the summer or at a time where there's a dearth if that happens where you are. Like, she will still lay an egg, but the workers will consume it. They'll get rid of it. They won't raise the brood because they don't need more mouths to feed if they don't have food coming in. They will self-regulate that. I cannot tell you how many times every single year that someone comes to me, and it's the same thing that I said in my first few years, like, oh, crap, oh, my God, I lost my queen. I killed my queen. My queen's dead. She left. Queens don't just leave, right? If you're a mated queen, well, not if, you know what I mean? If there's a mated queen, she's not going to be like, hey, I'm kind of bored. I think I'm going to leave today. If that queen leaves, it's because she's swarming. It's because they are absconding. Yeah, but she doesn't just get bored and be like, I think I'm going to try something new. You guys aren't doing it for me. But that time of year, if you have that dearth, you won't see any eggs or larvae. And you're used to what you've been seeing from, you know, March, April, May. And now all of a sudden there's nothing. And you're like, oh, my God, what am I going to do? I got to get a new queen. Really, really dig through those frames. More likely than not, she is still there. Like I said, she may still be laying a little bit. And that just keeps her pheromone up. She needs to keep laying to be a laying queen, to keep her at her strongest. But that doesn't mean the workers are going to raise that brood. So what are you doing after that nectar flow is you're really monitoring the food and the resources that they have. They do still need to stay alive. They're going to start consuming some of the things they've gathered. This kind of goes back to learning more about your area through Bee Club or from other people who are in your area who already know what the expectations would be. As an example, I did an inspection on a hive today. I think it's got probably about 40 pounds of honey, maybe somewhere in that ballpark. They have enough right now to overwinter. Like, if we were going into winter right now, I wouldn't worry at all. They're going to be great. The problem is they've got to get through the next 2 months before there's any other additional flow that comes in. So keeping an eye on that is important. Now, like where we are, where we have that dearth, we get a break in the brood cycle. So the small hive beetle doesn't have a place to lay its eggs. Varroa doesn't have a place to lay its eggs. So it's really beneficial to help us out, but you still have to keep a close eye out. You still have to look for everything. So you still have to, you know, you're going to do an inspection and you may be operating 100% on the expectation of seeing nothing new or exciting, but you still got to check around and make sure, is there any kind of thing going on inside that's not supposed to be there? And again, I go back to the hive beetles, wax moth, anything that looks, you know, if there is a break in the brood cycle, then a lot of your brood diseases or brood based problems, so, you know, chalk brood and alfalfa brood and all these things, they should not be an issue. Now that it doesn't, just to make sure we're setting the record straight here, if you have foul brood spores in your colony and there is a break in the brood cycle, that doesn't mean everything is okay. I think those spores, I believe they can live about 40 years inside of a frame. So you are not safe just by having a break in the brood cycle. Now, the next part of that question is, and I hope I answered that. I mean, there's a lot of things that you still have to keep doing after that initial phase is over, because really that's the fun, right? The spring is the fun part. I love the spring. Everybody's happy and they're excited and they're taking pictures and videos and there's swarms and swarm traps and like, it just can't get any better. And then you get into the summer and like, that's where the problems start happening. And then you get into the, like, you get in those times where you start having robbing and you start having fights between, you know, yellow jackets and different hornets. And it, you know, why can't we all just get along? So yeah, it's, you're about to get some education here. And I'm going to try to focus the next few episodes in these areas so that you kind of have a heads up as to what to expect when you're going into whether you have a dearth or not, you are going to be going into the fall at some point. Like I've said many times before, right now the bees are planning for the winter. They are trying to gather as much as they can now to help get them through the winter. So the next question on that second part of that question was ways to draw comb without a hive top feeder during the dearth. Now that was very specific. I don't think that they were specifically saying it has to be a top feeder. I mean, it doesn't matter, right? Whether it's a top feeder, frame feeder, open feeder, you know, whatever jar feeder, whatever you might be using, it's the same either way. The only thing I would say that is a little bit different, obviously, if you're using a, you know, an open feeder, you're feeding everybody in the neighborhood. If it's a time of dearth, you may be bringing in things that you don't want to have, like some hornets or yellow jackets or whatever. For the most part, they can kind of track down the honeybees on their own, but you don't want to draw them in. But those entrance feeders, man, I can't stress enough about how dangerous those are at a time of year when there's no nectar flow. You're gonna really have some bad things happen if you keep using those. But they are only going to draw comb if there's a food source. Drawing comb is very resource intensive for the bees. Producing and drawing the comb is very resource intensive. So whether the food source is natural or synthetic, we can make the nutritional debates and arguments later on, but from a drawing comb standpoint, it doesn't matter. Whether it's synthetic via sugar or pollen substitute, however it gets there, if the food's coming in, they're raising brood, they're drawing comb, and they're trucking along. So you're not really going to get them to draw comb without feeding them. Now, you can get into the argument of, you know, 1-to-1 sugar concentration versus 2-to-1. And I used to do the same thing in the past, too. I would go back to my book and open it up every time. Am I supposed to do 1-to-1 or 2-to-1? I can't remember which one is for comb, which one is for brood production. And then Michael Palmer saved the day when he was like, I just do 2-to-1 for everything. It just makes more sense. And here's why. He had a full like 15-minute explanation. And ever since then, I'm like, you know, you're smarter than me on honeybees. I'll just keep doing that. So I always do a 2-to-1. And that's kind of where I am.
When I was little, my grandmother had bird feeders and a bird bath in her backyard. Some of my favorite memories growing up were listening to her tell me everything she knew about the feathered friends that visited her yard daily. How amazing would it have been for us to be able to capture images and videos of that experience and to be able to share them with others? Well, if you're ready to take your backyard bird watching to the next level, FeatherSnap makes Wi-Fi-enabled smart bird feeders that blend the best of technology and nature. Get a high-def glimpse of your feathered friends with a top-of-the-line camera so every visitor can be seen with clarity and detail. A unique dual-feeder bin helps attract more species, and built-in solar panels keep your camera's battery going strong. FeatherSnap's mobile app creates a truly immersive experience, allowing you to collect and organize your favorite pics and videos and earn badges along the way. Best of all, FeatherSnap offers expert-trained AI identification of more than 275 North American species thanks to their in-house ornithologist. Check them out today at feathersnapcam.com. That's feathersnapcam.com.
As most of you know, I'm a big fan of the outdoors, and most of my time is dedicated to beekeeping and gardening-related discussions. But you probably did not know that one of my responsibilities as a kid was caring for our houseplants. Yes, part of my $5 a week allowance went towards making sure all of the houseplants were healthy and happy. We used to have shamrocks, Christmas cactus, philodendron, and more. Which leads us to today's podcast sponsor, and a special thanks to Palm Street. Palm Street is the best live shopping app for the plant lover community. You can buy and sell rare plants, crystals, ceramics, and other unique goods. Connect with trusted plant sellers and nurseries that sell nationwide. Shop 24/7 and with live human customer support. What I love most about Palm Street is joining a live stream where sellers walk through all the details and characteristics of the plants they're offering. You can get live answers to your questions and see what questions others have asked as well. It's such a great way to engage for buyers and sellers. And as a special offer, new users will receive $5 app credit, 10% off their first order, and up to $6 off shipping for 3 orders. Palm Street, available on Google Play or the App Store.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.
The next question, do you ever take a frame out so that the bees will draw fat comb? I guess, stay up to date on all the terminology. So I actually had to search that. I don't know what fat comb means. And it turns out basically what they're saying is if you had a 10 frame honey super and you pulled it out and created additional space and only put 9 frames in, you would then allow the bees to draw deeper comb, which would then produce more honey per frame. I have done that not deliberately, but where a situation where the bees have, for whatever reason, drawn the comb up in a less than optimal way, And instead of trying to like Jenga fit them back in exactly right every time, or what's not Jenga? What's the game where the Tetris, instead of like trying to like Tetris fit them in, I'll just pull one out and give them 9. Like I said, I know that you can get more honey per frame. I don't know that you get more honey per super that way. It's not something that I deliberately do, but I think that, you know, if you want to do that, there's obviously nothing wrong with it. What I don't know is if you were to use like a commercial decapper, I don't know how that would work. Are they already preset to a certain width, or is that customizable if you decided to go with a deeper comb? I don't really know much about that, but not something that I do. I don't think it's something that you have to do, but certainly an option. What's the best way to rotate nuke frames out? So if they are in the middle and there's brood on them, is it okay to move them to the outside or to pull it once the brood is out and they can fill it with honey? I'm trying to read the way the question was written a little bit, so I apologize. So getting bees to draw comb, you know, there's two things with it. There's one, the flow side of it, which we just discussed. And then there's the location of the asset or the resource or whatever you want to call it. Those two things need to be kind of operating in tandem. So as an example, I cannot tell you again, like how many times this happens. Like I threw an entire medium on top of this hive and they swarmed. Why? That doesn't make sense. They had all this space. And it goes back to the you and I space versus the bee space. And that's where breaking up the brood chamber or breaking up a honey super, breaking these things up a little bit can just force them to be like, what are you doing? This isn't where I want things. We got to start over. It kind of just gets, it forces them to engage whatever you've put in the middle of wherever. So specifically, let's say you have, like this person made reference to a nuke. So let's say you have a nuke where there's a 5-frame nuke and the middle 3 frames are drawn, they're packed, and you're getting swarm cells already. And then you look on the 2 outer frames and they're not even being touched, right? In that scenario, I think it makes perfect sense to go ahead and take, let's say if we map these frames out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? If we just numbered them left to right, take out frame 5 that's not being used, push frames 4 to the 5 position, 3 to the 4 position, and then drop the original one that you just pulled out right into the number 3 position. So now it's in the middle of the brood chamber. You know, this is the same thing that we've discussed, you know, several times before. But as long as there still is a nectar flow coming in, they do still like to keep the brood in the center of everything. That's why you'll see, let's just assume you're using a double brood setup, 8 or 10 frame, doesn't matter. You'll notice that they'll start out in the bottom and they might do 3, 4, 5 frames of brood. And then you're trying to get them to draw up above because you want to make sure they have plenty of space available. You pull 1 brood frame up into the next super, drop empty foundation right in the middle where that just came from. They draw the foundation up in no time. Workers come up and they follow that brood up. And within a few weeks, you end up with probably 6 or 7 frames of brood below, basically, and maybe 3 or 4 up above. But the entire area gets surrounded by honey. So they'll put a frame or two of honey on each edge. You get into that upper deep. You may have 3 on one side, 2 on the other. And then everything above that is all honey. So anytime you break up what the bees want and where they want to put things, it forces them to engage that thing. So I say go ahead and do it. Now, what I don't do, and I'm not trying to pick on anybody who does, and I'm not saying that it's wrong, right? And that's where I tell you guys all the time, and do what you find that you like. You find something that's working for you, just do it. And I say this over and over again. Don't listen to what everybody and their brother tells you have to do. I'm not telling you that this is wrong, but people talk a lot about checkerboarding their supers or their hive bodies. And they'll say, well, I had 3 frames of comb that were drawn up. I wanted them to draw everything else, so I just pushed everything left and right, and I just dropped an empty frame of foundation in between every one of them. Cool. Yep, they'll draw it up. You go back in there a couple weeks later, see, it's all done. Like I said, as long as you're on a flow, they will still do that. What I like to do, though, is that they put things in a place for a reason. Like, I know in the spring I'm going to be in that hive every week. So let's have them keep all the things right there where they want them with 1 frame next to the other so they can reach back and forth. They can get the pollen. They can get the bee bread. They can make their royal jelly. They put everything and they're all right there next to each other. You start moving things and spreading them way out. One, if you get some cold nights, It makes it more difficult for them to keep the brood warm, which is critically important. And two, it just has them doing a lot of extra running around. So, like, again, I'm not saying that checkerboarding all your frames is wrong. I just don't like to do more than one. If I have to, two, okay, you know, big population, one in one super, one in the other or whatever. Okay, cool. I just don't do it across all of them. That's just me. And there's another note I wanted to bring up too. This is something that I commented on in the Discord room on this specific question about the best way to rotate frames. And I said, honey frames that I intend to extract from are always separated from brood frames. I wouldn't say that's a mandatory thing. That's just what I do. I prefer the most pristine conditions possible for anything that is intended for human consumption. The dark comb by itself is fine. That's just a typical brood comb. It actually makes it a lot easier to locate the eggs on the darker brood comb than on the brand new white comb. I usually run my comb for 3 to 5 years before I replace it, removed immediately in the presence of any disease or potential issue. The real measure for me is when the comb is dark and brittle. If you grab a piece and try to bend it and it breaks off, it's probably about time to replace it. If you just want the outside frames drawn, pull one into the position three in a five frame nuke right in between two brood frames. And if you're on a flow or feeding sugar syrup, they'll draw it up and put it to use pretty quickly. And you probably just heard the ding of somebody sending an email while we were recording here. Okay, next question. Hello, newbie here. I'm going to give some background and then the question. We are new to beekeeping. We have our first hive and we're using something similar to a flow hive. Must have bought the Chinese knockoff. I am going to tell Cedar about that. For those of you who don't know, if you didn't hear the episode, Cedar is the co-creator and owner of Flowhive out there in Australia. We bought packaged bees. They came earlier this month. When we got them, we placed them in the brood chamber. We read that bees need to accept the queen, so we kept her in the queen cage and dangled it in the middle, stapling the strap to the frame next to it. I had not yet listened to the podcast episode about packaged bees at that time. We have a 10-frame box and just made space by removing one frame. When we did our first inspection to release the queen, we noticed that the bees had built comb hanging off the queen excluder. It wasn't large, but we left it. We released the queen, but did not add the 10th frame. We just went to do another inspection. The comb hanging was much larger, and I was worried we wouldn't be able to get the frame in, so I scraped it off and let it sit in the middle of the box. The inspection showed 3 to 4 frames with significant comb, and the rest was just a little. We're 2 weeks in. There are even ones that obviously looking like larvae. The question we have is, did we make a big mistake leaving that comb in there? Does that cause issues? Is there a way to put it on a frame? Do we take it out? Thank you for your help. First thing I would say is no need to worry about a queen excluder when you're first installing a single deep. Like if you put one deep in and you do want to use a single brood chamber approach, you don't need to add a queen excluder until you add additional hive bodies on later on. That's kind of the first thing. Now, the one thing I want to talk about is, you know, I always mention the Discord room and the little community that we have going on there. So this is somebody else who jumped in and responded to this. This is Dave in the Discord room. And he says, you know, I'll let Jeff chip in here, but what you want to do is remove that comb as it's going to cause issues with inspecting and working your hive in the future as they may attach it to an adjacent frame. Once removed, you'll want to add the 10th frame and push the frames tight together and center them in the box. You can place the comb in a foundationless frame held in place with rubber bands if it is significant in size and has brood. Plenty of videos online for this reference. Another thing to note, I'm not sure what you need a queen excluder for. That's okay. Well, he already said it here. Another thing to note, I'm not sure that you need a queen excluder at this point. As a rule of thumb, you'll add a second box once the first one has about 7 drawn frames in the first brood chamber. Then you can add your second brood box or queen excluder and honey super if that's your choice. And the only thing that I confirmed on that was I agreed with what he said. I recommend taking the frame, empty frame, rubber bands around those sections of comb and just drop them in right in that middle slot or wherever the missing frame was, and they'll attach it to the frame and everything will be good to go. But anyway, I thought that was pretty cool because, like I said, there's lots of questions. You don't have to have me answering the questions. There's tons of smart people in there. Lots of people are participating and they're trying too. I mean, you don't have to know everything. If there's one thing that you know really well, then cool, talk about it, right? So that's what's really great about the Discord. Okay, I'm curious about the commercial strategy of stacking boxes on pallets or using 4 to 5 frame stacked colonies on top of a 10 frame deep. In these situations, it seems the general rule of facing the entrance a certain direction has to be completely ignored in order to use the space efficiently. Have you seen any evidence to show a lack of production from colonies facing north or west? So the response I put was, you know, the benefits from the pallets, which you probably already know, is the ease of mobility and their abundant availability. That's what makes them so appealing for commercial beekeepers, as they can be easy to load and unload with track loaders, skid steers, and or forklifts. I don't believe there's any measurable impact whatsoever to the direction of hive placement as it relates to pollination or resource collection. The only benefits I see in my area are to reduce the, you know, the winter winds and the water from driving rains, which usually originate from the west. And then I kind of said, well, that being said, maybe next year I'll take a row of 8 to 10 and face them to the north and do the same thing with another group and face them to the west and see how they do. But no, I don't see anything measurable with that. I think most of us have agreed, as the discussion kind of carried on, that if there's sunlight shining on the entrance, they may tend to wake up a little bit earlier and start their day a little earlier. Or if the sun is not visible later in the day, they may wrap up their workday a little bit earlier, things like that. But I personally have not seen anything and have done no testing around that. Next question. So, hello, I was just curious if screen bottom boards are worth it or if there are any downsides. So somebody else commented, I'm only in my second year, but the screen bottom boards I have a removable piece of plastic coated cardboard beneath the screen. Apparently some use this to try to look for mites, but it also allows you to close off the bottom during colder months and open it up to give them more ventilation in the summer. It also apparently helps with mite control, as they can't crawl back up into the hive once they fall down through the screen. I've used both, but I don't have enough colonies or time to say whether one was better than the other. Lots of variables. Now, one thing I remember when I first started, I remember this discussion going back and forth. I think it was like the Fat Bee guy down in Georgia, and he was like, I just use solid bottom boards. I don't need anything else. There's no screen bottom boards in a tree, right? That's kind of the mindset that I try to go to sometimes when I think about this. Like, if you are in the woods and you see a tree and then you just want to mimic the tree, right? Just do it just like it is in the tree and you should be okay. I definitely understand that philosophy and that approach. I get it. I'll tell you what, here's my response. I said, I used solid bottom boards my first year. Then in year two, went to the screen bottom boards in the spring and would swap them out with the solid boards in the fall. A few years ago, I started using the screen bottom boards year round and just sliding like a 3/32 piece of board into the rails that are underneath the screened bottom board. That's what whoever responded had previously mentioned a few minutes ago, the board that you can slide in and out. And that effectively closes the bottom enough to not allow wind to blow directly in. I've also accidentally forgotten to put the boards in a couple of times and left the screen board in all winter. While that worked, I would not recommend doing that part. I believe that the two arguments are basically old school stubborn versus the maybe there's a better way crowd. Are there screen bottom boards in the woods? No. Do the bees beard less, abscond less, and seem overall more relaxed with a screen bottom board? In my experience, yes. If you live in a cooler northern climate, I would say it really doesn't matter and you can just use what you have. However, in the south, I love the ventilation that the screen bottom board provides. That combined with a vented inner cover, and I think, you know, you're in there like swimwear. And then I think I added in here, I think the worst argument for the screen bottom board is when people say that you can get an accurate mite count from them because they'll fall through the screen and you can count them on the board below. So we're to believe that one bee is maybe grooming another one, maybe in the middle of the entire hive somewhere, and that mite is now going to fall. And it's going to fall through thousands of bees, unimpeded, not going to hit anything, all the way to the bottom, and fall right through the screen. Like, I'm just not buying it, right? I think there is maybe a way where you could look at that board and say, okay, I'm going through this board. Like, the board that was referenced by whoever had made that comment, it's a grid. So it would be like, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, up and down, and so that you can actually look at counting so many mites per grid or whatever it might be. And I think you can put like a light coating of some oil or something sticky on there so that when the mite hits, it stays. Let's say you went through and you counted them. And you say, okay, in the past week on this board, I found 20 mites. And then you do an alcohol wash. And out of, you know, 100 bees, you find 4. So then you can maybe start to correlate. Okay, well, if I see 20 on the board, does that equal 4 per 100? So maybe you document that. And then next time you do an alcohol wash, you had 3. And on the bottom of the board, you had 15. there's some relationship, right? There's 25 on the board to every one I see in an alcohol wash of 100. If there's some kind of numerical correlation to that, then I think that makes a lot of sense. Outside of that, I don't see any possible way that you can do anything other than verify the presence or absence of mites by allowing them to fall all the way through everything down to the screen, through the screen, and onto the board. Well, folks, that's all I've got on this BeeBuzz episode. More questions have come up since I did the cutoff for this one. I'm still going to get Phoebe in here to talk to everybody. I've got an In the News segment that will go out tomorrow. Probably by the time that you're listening to this one, you'll probably be able to hear that one. But definitely by the close of business on Wednesday the 29th, we'll have the In the News segment out. I've got one interview scheduled for tomorrow. I've got another one scheduled for Thursday. And I'm working on getting another one for maybe even Friday. It just keeps coming. There's a whole lot going on. I got some videos I got to do. It just never ends. But it's so much fun because it's in the world of honeybees and you just can't go wrong. All right, folks. Well, that's all I got for you. Take care of yourselves. Be kind to one another. And I look forward to talking to you soon. Take care.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com. Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.